So I'm interested in how do you find quality in a with all that noise? And the point of this article is that she first of all describes this theater guy who was Tarragon Theater in Toronto for 20 years, in all of that time, he would read as many as 500 scripts a year and comment on them. And, you know, how valuable is that for a writer, right? I sort of think that's, we need something like that, you know? You need something where you take pictures and you sit down with somebody and talk about them. Or somebody who you respect looks at them and tells you what they think, you know, like that. I mean, otherwise there's nothing, you know. It's like it's just this mass. Reichman says there's 2 billion pictures a day made, you know.
Yeah, but and that's 2 billion. Actually, it's probably higher than that now. But of those 2 billion,
well, you said that a week ago.
Yeah, but most every second probably. Most of them aren't designed to be consumed beyond the immediate 3 seconds that people are together.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, you look at them. In fact, they're a lot of times when people take pictures with their devices or whatever, it's to share immediately with the people around you, and then it's the next person's
disposable.
Yeah.
And then they're peaked on the pile of billions.
But isn't it getting to the point where you're seeing the picture, and I could do that, just like you see some of the abstract art in the galleries.
Yeah. Sure. Mm-hmm.
I could do that. Sure. No problem.
I can do a voice of fire.
Art shows? Have you done art shows?
A lot.
Okay, well then that's what happens. It's like a sticky fly for photographers. So they all walk in and say, oh.
And how many people try and find the exact tripod legs of Antelope and use the holes in the ground for...
They're probably plated.
Yeah, probably.
Oh, I see. That one place.
Yeah. You know, there's always a chance that the good stuff will float.
Yeah, but the pool has gotten awfully large.
I want to say something crude. It's just the only people talk, and that had an expression for it called it verbal diarrhea.
Right.
So in a way, that's what's happening with images. You know, yeah. It's just so much that you. It's hard to find the good because it's covered with crap.
Yeah. No, it's true. And I mean, if you run into a person like that, you can ignore them, but you can't ignore this. No, it's all around you.
But it dulls the senses. I think it desensitizes. My problem is like I don't know why I'm not as successful as I would like to be.
Uh-huh.
But I think it's educating the public. Because sometimes the public will settle for less.
Yeah.
Because they're inundated.
Yeah.
And they could be desensitized.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't know the difference between a good photograph and a bad photograph.
Yeah. No, it's true. And in that interview, I just watched this thing, so you know I've got all kinds of quotes here. Brooks Jensen, you know who he is. Everybody know. His lens work is a website, a magazine, a podcast. He's got a whole industry going, and I really like him. Anyway, he said one time, by chance, they had a print that they printed in three different ways. One was platinum print, one was silver gelatin, I forget what the other one was. And so they were having a show, so they put them all up together. And, you know, we could sort of bunch this out and make it be more round rather than long.
Linear?
Sure. Yeah. What do you think? Like, bring that long table in where you guys are sitting and then sit back around it? Michael have to move everything.
Yeah.
But it'd be better than moving away.
You gotta do everything, Jake. Yeah, you gotta organize these meetings.
Meetings?
Organize ourselves at these things too.
Yeah. Don't touch this table though.
Yeah.
Like even don't let it rock. Touch the table.
Does that work?
Yeah.
Brilliant.
So we put up these three prints, And all the photographers who walked in said, oh, wow, you know, nice platinum print, nice silver gelatin print. They were admiring the work and all this. But anybody who was an outsider walked in and said, why do you have three up? You know, but they were educatable, you know. I mean, he found that people who were interested, I mean, he would say, these are not three the same. These are three different kinds of printing. And see the difference here and there. And they would learn. Well, you don't learn that when you're flooded by 2 billion a day. You know, it's like, you know, I mean, it takes time and it takes focus, right?
I think it's easy to get lost in that 2 billion because not all that 2 billion is meant to be viewed beyond the 30 seconds.
Mm, sure.
So that's, you know, you gotta present your images to the group that is interested.
Yeah.
Either a gallery setting or a website. Or
yeah. Well, that's another of Brooks Jensen's main items, really, is find the audience. Mm-hmm. That, find the audience that wants you.
Also depends on what your ambitions are, your own ambitions are, and what you want to do with your pictures, right?
Yeah.
You just want to take a picture to share with your buddies.
Yeah.
It's one thing. If you want to create high art in every museum, worth mentioning, that's another ambition. I mean, it's sure. Everything in between. So,
yeah.
where do you want to fit in this, the scale of things?
I've always said I wanted to make enough money to support my habit. You know, but I've never done that.
You want it to become a revenue stream. That's another.
Yeah, yeah.
But then it becomes more.
Worms.
Even if you're trying to do fine art work, it then becomes commercial.
Yeah.
And again, catering the work to your audience rather than the work you want to do.
Not necessarily, but.
So what is the question? Sorry.
Well, I've never made it, so. Sorry.
What's the question? Sorry. Just
the question? No, it's just, you know, how do you deal with photography in the world of mass photography?
Okay.
Yeah. You have some experience with this.
Well, I think that, you know, it's present in all the visual arts. But photography, I think, has a particular issue with that. I mean, you can do painting, drawing, printmaking, you know, and so forth. But anybody can have a camera and call themselves a photographer. And like I say, you know, they could have a properly exposed, technically, you know, decent photograph.
A rendition,
nice.
Huh? It's a rendition.
Well, it's a, in my opinion, it's a difference between a snapshot and you know, there's a lot of bad paintings out there. There's a lot of everybody, you know, a lot of people take painting classes and paint their kitty cats or their flowers. Those are big, you know. And,
oh yeah, more and more.
And they don't claim to be painters. They claim to be hobbyists or amateurs or Sunday painters, whatever. But anybody who's got a camera, even if it's an iPhone, is a photographer.
I mean, some guys just take pictures of flowers and stuff too, right? Just kidding, Jake.
But I'm taking pictures of flowers by itself. I mean, you know, it's fine. Any subject is fine. But I mean, it's like, you know, people learn about f-stops, they learn about shutter speeds, they learn about a little bit about compositioning or something, and they, you know, they can make a properly exposed photograph.
That goes back to the camera, because I've heard the stories that they'll look at the camera on your neck and they get awed by the equipment. So part of it is getting the consumer is naive, and they'll say, wow, that's a sexy camera, you must be good.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
And then the guy that has the camera will run the game.
Sure, but it's always the camera is always on automatic. You know, they don't, you know, there's no creativity.
So that goes back to the billboards made by Apple saying this picture was done on an iPhone.
Yeah, but who did it? That's
yeah,
the thing.
Yeah, that's part of it.
Whose eye was behind it?
And how much how much processing got there before it hit the billboard either. Hmm. Overall, depends what you're chasing. I mean, it's make as many pictures as you like.
I was always in the impression that you'd have to do it on a consistent basis to call yourself a photographer.
But with digital photography, I mean, it's so cheap, it's so easy. You know, when the days when all you had was a darkroom and you did your own darkroom work, that was a very different thing.
And we've dumbed down the cameras.
Yeah.
I mean, anybody can pick up.
So it's all George Eastman's fault because he actually made it easy for us to just put something in a box.
Push the button and we'll do the rest.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a whole movement about snapshots as art. You know, going back to all those snapshots of your kid's birthday party or at the beach or whatever, the barbecue, you know, and there was a whole kind of thing about
Lobo?
But the art is not necessarily in the taking of the snapshot. The art is appropriating other people's snapshot and making art of it.
The art is still
making the snapshot is not making art.
No, it was a little bit tongue in cheek. Go back to all those shoeboxes and
but
find
you can make art with snapshots.
Oh yeah, sure. They make art with them.
Exactly.
Had a good story.
What is it about? If you can answer that question, you got it.
Actually, I think some of the photographs do well because there's been a good story written about it. Not necessarily the photograph is all that good, but the story written around it is, that's amazing when you look at it.
Yeah.
Topical. It's a good story around it.
Well, some people think of all of that as telling stories,
mm-hmm.
you know, and combination of words and picture or pictures or.
Mm-hmm. But sometimes you got to write 1,000 words so the picture can tell 100 words, you know.
Well, sometimes the photograph can change the events as well. Just look at the photograph the average people had with the little boy.
Yeah.
Syrian that washed up on the shore.
Mm-hmm.
We forget that there were thousands that drowned before that one.
Yeah.
But for some reason, that photograph opened up people's consciousness.
There was one that was even more dramatic, I think, at the news photographs that were over at the museum just recently.
Oh, yeah.
There was one over there that was even, it was even more graphic than that one.
And even some of the ones that are really famous, like Richard and I were down in Vermont in February to see Cone's print shop.
Okay? Yeah.
And we missed, Cone was there, but we missed Nachtwey. Cone is doing Nachtwey's prints. This is not, you know, the myth of Nachtwey shoots the image and, you know, it gets a little runoff on a 3880 and then that. They had those full-size, like 6 feet by whatever it was, prints up there, and Nachtwey had marked on, and Cone was doing the printing. You know what it reminded me of? Is Bartlett's book on darkroom printing. How many of those images, the printer did the image, the photographer took an image, and then you went to work on it, and you're the real, really should have gotten credit for what we're looking at and saying what a beautiful picture it is, you know?
That's something that's bothered me about Spao is, at least for the digital, Michael does most of the printing, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, that's a great thing and a problem at the same time.
All right.
Food break.
The
Oh,
that's
right.
I had a burger. That's
me.
Do you want to pass that down, please?
Sure.
Thank you. And I have a
Take some fries on
Don't give me
some
lungs. Can
I get a Coke?
Of course.
Because Michael has a certain look. But he's a great printer.
Yeah,
and
that's right.
It's like anything else. It's you learn by observing, and once you figured it out, you can then do what you want to do.
Yeah, but the problem at Spao, though, is that so much of what comes out of there is printed by Michael.
You got to get out of the school and do your own stuff.
Yeah. And do they get taught to print digitally?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah? Okay.
Oh, yeah.
They get to practice, too? I mean, they seldom do the exhibition work.
Buy a printer and print.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. But so much of it, I mean, so many of them don't do that. I guess it's interest. I don't know.
There seems there is a bias towards the traditional darkroom and silver and gelatin and so on.
Yeah.
But you figure out that you want to do digital printing and learn by observing Michael and by observing Jim and observing whoever else is teaching their digital printing.
Yeah, yeah.
And once you've figured out how they do it, then you can do your own thing.
Sure. That's a fascinating juxtaposition. You know, I've taken both classes from both of them.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like, Michael's just so, you know, sort of artistic, you know, like work to print, you know, and Jim is,
Lamont's by the numbers.
Jim does it too, but he does it very, very numerically,
Yeah, I've had Michael do some of my prints, and I said, how did you do that? And he said, I don't know.
Yeah.
Just because he sat there and did it, you know, and then it's done.
He makes it look the way he wants it.
Yeah, he thinks this is good.
Yeah.
I don't always agree. But
and then what do?
I change it.
Okay.
Then you go to Costco and you get it done.
Yeah, get it done properly.
That's right.
But I know I have one of your sheep portraits in my, you know, embedded in my head somewhere.
Oh, yeah.
And it looks like a Michael print.
Which one is it?
I don't know one.
Yeah.
Yeah. That blue.
It could be. Some of the early ones were.
Okay.
And I mean, that's why you. And if you bought it that day, you got the gray version or the blue version or whatever.
Having been behind the counter of many photo stores over the last X number of decades, it's been interesting watching the progression of people, but it still comes down to, you know, somebody looks at an image, like a lot of times they're just looking and saying, oh, that's Aunt Mary, that's, you know, Grantham, Jim, or something like that. And they determine the value and the quality of the image based on the content of who's in it to them.
Yeah.
You know, it could have been poorly printed or poorly exposed or something like that, but oh, that's a great picture because look at the way Grandma smiled.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the public really don't care about the quality of the image. And if the lab got it wrong, more often people will assume it was their fault.
Oh, yeah.
The lab's fault. Or that the lab didn't do the little extras that they could have to make a quality image.
I have to print. I shot a wedding in early August, and I have to print it. They haven't come back to me with what they want printed, but I'm realizing that I've got to be careful here. I can't tell them what I worry about, because that's just going to put a negative on it. You know?
Mm-hmm.
It's like they love the pictures. The content is there, right? But I'm just appalled at some of the choices I made in shooting. You know,
Well, how many times have you shown your body of work to somebody, and there's this one image that you think is your absolute favorite? Like this is just gangbuster.
Yeah.
But the one everyone seems to want like is the one you kind of go, eh.
Yeah.
That's an exercise I did at Algonquin. You had to pick 100 images and then show the 100 images to someone else.
Uh-huh.
And then they would rank them.
Oh.
It's quite editing. It's a whole while down to editing. Probably shouldn't be your own editor.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. No, that's true.
That's
right.
And that's also part of what then starts to strip out the cream from those beans and beans of images that are done. From, you know, the good stuff is the curation side of it. And that, I think, is where the interest should be, is the curation part.
The duration.
Curation.
Curation.
Edit.
Yeah. Somebody else edit.
The one that
or not just somebody else. You can edit your own work if you want.
Yeah,
but it's the, you know, these are the ones that, you know, I want to display.
What is the collection?
Yeah. reflection or, you know, making the story behind it. Or,
and does anybody teach that? Does anybody teach curation in photography?
Grants for it. Grants for being a curator, but I've never figured out.
I think they mean something else.
Machine that curates?
What was your question? Curator.
Does anybody teach photographic curation? And really, it's a funny word, eh? I mean, it means so much and so little now. That, I mean, people curate their lipstick, you know. But I think you know what I mean by it, and it's what we're talking about. Choosing images wisely, well, according to impact and other things that are important in images. Just wonder if anybody teaches that.
Well, I've seen, but in more, I do not recall in a Canadian, but in American universities, it's a degree in curation. But I think they weren't pitched solely at a photographic curator. They were picked at, the idea is you're going to go work in a museum as a curator, and you'll probably specialize maybe eventually in photography, but you know they were teaching a more holistic
visual.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's more, I think that's come to mean more an impresario than anything. As somebody who organizes cultural items, and they may dig into the history, and they may contact people who have items, and they may, you know, they
it's
may.
It's part of curation. It's part you need to know the background of what you're showing, who the author, the artist, who created it, what's.
But you also have to market it too.
Who you're going to show it to, what's the purpose of the exhibit, is it to sell, to present, is this a selection of a life's body of work, or is it one specialized exhibit for a specialized series of new work or something? There's all kinds of issues.
Well, when we talk about, well, we started off talking about basically, I mean, I think of it as a kind of edit.
A sequencing, a choosing
of
what the written component is going to look like, and how extensive it's going to be, the lighting of the images.
I'm going to do a shameless plug for one of my classes at Spell.
Good. Okay.
Which is curation.
sort of.
I had that in mind when I asked.
It actually does tie into it a little bit because I've got one on Sunday mornings, which I call Urban Vision. And it really is about first talking about other photographers or people that you admire. But the real crux of the class is we go out for an hour and photograph. And we also go out in the same area multiple times so that my goal is that they get bored of that area, but then that's when the magic starts to happen and they start looking deeper for images. But then the last part of the class is they have to present an image that they've taken the week before. And that is presented to the class. So at that point, and they also have to print it. Part of that is because I'm forcing them to find one image, and they're only allowed to print one image. So that is forcing them to choose and do it all in curation, and then bring it up for discussion. And also forcing them to print is also getting them to commit to an image, because if they just sent it by a PowerPoint or whatever, they don't commit to that. They'll say, okay, I'll just throw this up and see what they say. But as soon as you get somebody to hit that print button or in their mind say, I am committing to this image, I'm spending money. You get a dollar or $20 if they go to some place to get a printed out. But there's that committing part to it.
And you have room in that class?
Yes. A little bit. Start September 27th. They're on the day. SPAO.ca.
Never heard of that place.
No, but it's partly the curation side. It's a self-curation,
yep.
But also opening up for discussion and bring in at what we think is the art side of things.
I think that's really what I meant when I said, does anybody teach it? It's self-curation. Because that's really hard to learn.
Yep.
You know, it sounds like a good effort.
It's removing your emotion.
Sunday morning.
You have to remove your emotion from the image sometimes and
I don't know if it's removing your emotion. No, that's quite the opposite. I think it's opening up your emotions and being receptive, and you know it's honing your skills as well in terms of being able to see. Because it's not about the technology. That class is anything but. Like if somebody wants to do the whole course with a phone, they're welcome to it, or a 4x5 or a DSLR. It's all about learning to see.
With practice, your emotion can get pulled. That's again thinking of my own experiences where the last time I did a series, I looked at something and I knew right away that was my best photo. And when I showed the photos to other people, they came back and started saying that's the best photo. Maybe not always, but 50% of the time. But you do want to figure out sometimes what your best stuff is. Sometimes you're not always right. Sometimes you're off by one.
Yep. I find it fascinating for myself, because I go out with the students as well, and I present something each week, but I still have to go to my wife and say, this one or that one?
Yeah.
But that's where you need the second opinion, right?
Yeah.
I do the same thing. I'll shoot, and I'll come up with 20 photographs or something that I think are great, but I certainly want a second or third opinion to take a look at it and say, what do you think of this?
Mm-hmm.
I don't trust myself, I guess, that's why.
But I like the idea of putting all your eggs in, like going, putting all the chips on that one number and saying that's the one. I like that.
Sunday morning.
But really, I mean, if you're looking for just one image, if you do a proper curation, you need to build your story, right?
Yes.
Which means a continuation of the images. So you have to build a block of images that have some kind of cohesion. You can't have fireplaces and doors. All fireplaces or all doors. So you're missing something by thinking just
not necessarily, because you can still have, call it again, because it's geographically based, you can say it's all fireplaces and doors within a particular region.
And this
depends on what you want to define your story.
And this is the penultimate image that represents all of that. So you're going to work through that in 3 weeks? Is that,
you know, some people might actually take their best image. Like it's actually 6 weeks of photographing.
Okay.
Some people might actually take their best image the first week. Some people might do it the last week. It's, who knows? But, you know, the goal is to actually broaden your viewing, being able to look beyond your obvious. Because that's even something I learned from Rich Jensen. He talked about this before. You know, you go out and you head to a particular place, go out and take that cliche shot first. And then once you've got that cliche shot out of the way, then you start looking at, okay, what else can I do here? Where else can I look? What am I, you know, what nuances can I put to this?
Mm-hmm.
And that's really where you start getting your juices going.
Mm-hmm. But that's, I think where you've also got to be careful in the use of the term curation. I mean, what do you mean? Most of what we've talked about when we've, in here right now, when we've been using the word curation, we're talking about in terms of a project that we're shooting, a theme or subject. But go to the National Art Gallery and look at the Corbeil, well, if you did the Corbeil shot, that wasn't about a project, that was a curation of his life story and how he worked and all the phases of his work.
Mm-hmm.
That's what linked it all together. But that was the story. That's right.
Yeah.
I started wondering about the word when I think probably I heard Michael say it first. He talked about curating one of the red wall things.
Yeah.
Or maybe the exposure. I don't know. And, what do you do? And then I started looking around, and somebody else said, I curated that. You know,
Well, what did it do?
What do you do?
You tell a story on the wall.
Yeah. Well, that's an ideal.
And you end with the end.
Yeah.
And everything in between has a sort of a logical flow. And it's through the choice of images
the flow, the sequencing, yeah, how they're lit, how they're presented, how they're framed, the color of the wall, the color of the frame, the color of the size, and all that stuff, and the written component, and that's curation. You have chosen deliberately these and left beside, and, you know, left out that that bunch of pictures. So these are the ones you're going to show, and this sequence.
Okay, neither one of those did. Neither one of the ones I'm thinking of did that.
Well, they should have.
That's why I was wondering. You know, what are they doing? Well,
but it's the challenge of also the individual saying, I'm curating this show, what are you working on? Like Richard Freeman and I have got a show coming up at Exposure in November, okay? Michael's working on us, he's curating it, okay?
Yeah.
But I mean, part of the curation is we've got a limited space. There's so many of you, a certain number of you. Yeah. So, you know, that's part of the equation he's trying to figure out. But as Richard said, so in that, they're looking at, okay, what are the best pictures to represent your project? Because we're not going to be able to show your whole project. We don't have enough space to do that for everyone. So select those, whittle them down. What's the story you're writing? How it's going to be lit? What sizing are you going to use? Except for them. So he uses the word curation in that context.
Yeah.
I totally agree with you. And then he would turn over and he puts on, you know, I curated the A+3 exhibit on the Redwall Gallery. Well, that's every image from 33 students who submitted that he selected. Well, okay, had to work on, but there's not a sort of story there. This is a representation of the different styles of work that the school does.
Mm-hmm. So it's a broad tent.
It's a process.
It's a broad tent. It means a lot of different things.
Yeah, and when you look at one that's really well curated, and then you go look at one that's not, you really notice the difference.
Yeah.
Not always sure why, but you do notice the difference. You look at some of the ones in some of the restaurants around town, right? Yeah. Some nice images in there, but you go, okay, that's this, that's how it is. There's no relation between them.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas a properly curated one, there is some storyline, I find.
That reminds me of something that does everybody know Doris Lamontagne? She put out an image on Facebook today that was really funny.
The characters were foreign.
I don't know. Anyway,
CBC did a TV show quite a few years ago, 5-10 years ago, where they took 3 photographers and sent them to 3 different parts of Canada, but it had to be parts that they weren't familiar with. So a guy from Quebec ended up going to the prairies. A guy from Ottawa was sent to the Maritimes. And I think somebody else was sent out west. And they had to go to this particular place and find the story. And their images were brought back to Toronto and then presented as an exhibition, and then somebody would end up winning the prize of who is the best of all the 3. And one of the photographers was having a really hard time placing her images on the wall. And so the guy from Ottawa actually helped her place and position the images on the wall so that the story worked better. Maybe even to the detriment of having the time to properly set up his own work.
Oh, yeah.
Anyways, she ended up winning.
Oh!
So again, it goes down to the curation. Sequencing of those images.
Yeah. Well, that's what that thing's about. What is it? The curator becomes the artist?
Simon should be singing Photo Pump right now, shouldn't he?
Yeah, he should, shouldn't he? Yeah. Definitely.
So my original question was, what's the difference between photography, fine art photography, and photographic art? Or, another way to look at it is, what is it you're doing? You know, where do you fit in that? How do you differentiate those 3 things?
What's your question again?
What's the difference, what's the difference you would say between photography, good photography, fine art photography, photographic art? And where are you? What do you do?
No. That's a hard one to answer, because my concept of art, maybe that I don't know if it is or not, but it could be different than your concept of art.
I think it probably is. So
for me, it's self-expression.
Yeah.
And it's not easy to use photography as a means to do that. Photography is an easy medium to record things that are in front of you. So you record a moment, a place, a thing, or whatever, and you use a camera to record these things. That's easy. But to use a camera to create art the way I see art, which is self-expression, means pretty much setting up a scene. So I have to.
You define setting up a scene.
Set up a scene, right?
Where you
construction.
Like you actually bring the props or the people.
You have to construct things. I mean, you have to bring things into the image. I may have props. I may have the people. I may have to decide how the light is going to be, where this is going to be. What am I trying to do here, right? So, and the more I get into this, the more it gets complicated. But that's what I tend to be going towards.
But would we then not, based on your describing where you need to set up something.
Right.
Something like an Ansel Adams image, for example, where he just goes and really records.
I don't think he just goes and records.
No.
I think he...
There's darker marks that's afterwards, but...
Spent a lot of time figuring out where to go, when to go, how to set up...
Wait for the light.
Wait for the light.
And look at how many times he manipulated
the
image on, like, the graffiti that was on the mountain that he rubbed out, you know? Yeah, well,
just like
famous.
Just go out and take a snapshot. I don't think so. I don't agree with you. I mean, there is... I think it's actually ridiculous. Asked 10 million times with 10 million different answers. I mean, I one of the things I specialize in is travel photography. I'm not interested at all in fashion photography, but people who are interested in fashion photography in a studio can create some great art, right? But when I go out and I'm traveling, I don't have much control over the weather or the time of day or the quality of the sunlight. I have to use what's there. I'm aware of it, and I might make adjustments for it, but I'm working with what's there, as opposed to setting up a scene where you bring your lights and you say, I'll go late in the afternoon or go early in the morning, because that's what I choose to do. Some people have that luxury, if you want to call it that. And some people don't really care, but you're not going to have an exhibit with, say, fashion photography and what Lewis does in the same exhibit. You know, they just don't mesh, you know, but is, you know, so it's that whole thing about what is art. I mean, I'm tired of the question, really. You know,
it gets interesting in the market.
Yeah.
You know, if you're interested in that.
But it is in the eye of the beholder.
Yeah.
I mean, even looking in the market,
that is
how much stuff,
is
out there that people buy that, you know, you wouldn't.
People don't buy it because it's art. People buy it because it matches their sofa.
That's right.
You know, and this one is kind of got some greens in it, which matches my green in my carpet, you know. I mean, there are a lot of people like that. My wife is a painter, and she had a real estate agent
in Kanata who was renting her paintings for open houses.
Yeah.
You know, and the people could buy them if they wanted, but they didn't. But the real estate agent wanted some color in these houses. You know, I mean, and my wife's work at that time was very colorful.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's just another way of doing it.
That's right.
If you're thinking about the market, then you're thinking about business. And if you're thinking about business, you're not thinking about you're thinking about what sells. And that's another whole different kind of thing. And galleries are businesses. And, you know, gallery owners are going to hang what sells, regardless of the quality. Some will have a higher level of quality, but you could have the greatest photographs. But if he doesn't think they're going to sell, he's not going to put them on the wall. Because, and if he thinks that your $500 photograph should take the place of a $5,000 painting on the wall, you're wrong. Because that's a business decision. It's not an art decision.
Right. Of course.
You know, unless you have a show, you know, like in a city gallery or something, which is, you know, not a business,
not a
quote unquote.
No.
But I've run into this over and over and over. And the artists, the galleries that tend to survive are the galleries that do the right business, the ones that can sell art, you know. And I had a gallery in Florida that I had a gallery in Halifax, both of them were broken. So,
Well, I mean, I'm in negotiations with a Locke gallery, and he's very, very honest with me. I've had several discussions with him. He said to me, Glenn, look, he's noted as being a gallery for collectors of classical Canadian paintings. Okay? But he says, look, that's my reputation. That's a limited market. I've got solid collectors. When I get one and I can pick it up, I know who to phone. You know, the bulk of my work that I sell, that pays the bills, is drop-in people off the street who just love the color or the image. And as he says, you know, it'll work in our place. Let's have that, okay? And it's got nothing to do with artistic talent, per se. I mean, there's some talent there, but, you know.
Is that an outdoor gallery?
It actually is in Winnipeg, Toronto, and either Calgary or Vancouver, I forget. He's got three of them.
What are you chasing? Are you chasing the market?
Well, exactly. Exactly.
I know. I was a couple of years ago. I was traveling in Arkansas, and I was visiting a friend, and he took me to this town which is very touristy and it's been around for 100 years and all that. And I won't mention any names, but around the corner, and on the outside of this building was this big canvas. I mean, it's two stories high, and it was a section of a painting, and it had to see the work of so-and-so. And I know that person, so I know of that person. So I went into the gallery, and I said, I know this painter and all that. Well, what this painter does is he sends his paintings there, and the section of the painting was a lot of vines and leaves. The people down there are the ones finished the vines.
They finish
and
it
leaves.
Off.
And this person is very successful.
Yeah.
Very successful.
Yeah.
In the business of art.
Yeah.
But it's got someone down there painting the leaves.
Well, that's like, what's her name? Sarah Thompson wrote Seven Artists in 7 Days or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
And that Chinese painter. And you go in, it's a factory.
Yeah.
He's got all these workers producing his work.
You
always see him, and he's famous. Wai, something.
That's how all the masters work. Rubens and
the
most people, they would do stuff, but it would be their apprentices.
They do the smile. They do the smile, and everybody's in charge of the rest.
I think it's a little more. A little more nuanced, though, than just choosing whether to make art or make money. It's like you get a reputation for doing something, and it's not necessarily, I mean, that has to do with making money, but what would you choose to call what you do? You know, is it, I do photography. You know, it doesn't sound quite the same as I do art photography.
Do you do what?
Fine art photography. Or
fine art.
Or do I do photographic art? Okay. You know, I mean, do I put a Smurf on the rock before I take the picture? You know, or whatever. You know, it's like, do I come up, do I, you know. So, I mean, it has to do with market, but it also has to do with reputation, which they're related, right?
Yeah, but how many, I'm trying to remember the names now, but how, I'll call them artists, you want to use that word in quote, who readily admit, look, I'm doing, you know, portraitures or weddings to pay the bills, because on the side is my, call it the art side, okay, what is my personal stuff, okay? And they're honest about that. You can't, you're not going, except for the real success, highly successful ones like Jeff Wald or something. I mean, who the heck in this country makes money out of art sufficient to live on? No.
Actually,
you have to have other jobs and whatever. I mean, it's nice.
I picked up a book with, I guess, writings by, Fred Lyons, but somebody Lyons, and he's started the big collection at Rochester.
Right.
And there was a line in there where I guess he was having drinks with his Lyons, there's another guy, and Gary Winograd. Uh-huh. And this is, I think, 62, 64, somewhere around there. And they're saying the only way a photographer can make money is to either teach or do some commercial type work.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, some of that's, you know, you can't teach anymore. And even the commercial work is growing. Not much has changed over the years. You know, then there wasn't any money for photography. Today there still is.
You know what Woody Allen said?
Yeah.
Woody Allen had a quote about that.
Yeah.
He said, those who can't do, teach. Those who can't teach, teach Jim.
That's good.
I hadn't heard the second half of
those who can't teach Jim, teach photography. Sorry, Mike.
Thank you.
You
stop
before me.
Well, photographers who made a lot of money have been in fashion or maybe in fashion. Some wedding, I guess, but
advertising.
Advertising.
Yeah.
The average artist in Canada makes $12,000.
Yeah.
And that's across all the artists.
Somebody owes me money.
Yeah.
I was gonna say.
Actors and painters and musicians and
sure it's not minus 12,000.
You know. And that's Revenue Cannabis. So there's some that are making
When we were getting SPOW registered for the permit. Ministry requires a labor market analysis. I remember crawling through that data, and I forget exactly the figure. It was something like either 92.6 or 96.2, something like that, of Canadian artists do not make enough money to live on. They all have 92.6 or 96.2 artists have other jobs to pay the bills.
I mean, it's photography. I mean, there's a few people who can make a living as a photographer.
Yeah.
I mean, doing their art.
Yeah.
But most are, if you're doing photography, you're doing weddings and you're doing, those kinds of things.
And even the famous ones that we think of, like, Ansel Adams, he was late in success. He ran a commercial business on the side, you know.
Oh,
but all the stuff we know about him was really became famous late in his career.
Publishing books.
Yeah.
Well, actually, you can even equate it to a baseball player. There are thousands upon thousands, even millions of kids throughout the world looking to play baseball. Every step of the way, there's a thinning out of the ranks.
Yeah.
And to the point where you only get a couple hundred that actually can make
money
playing baseball.
Yeah.
Used to read Robert Heinlein. Remember him? science fiction writer in the, from the 50s through the 70s, probably. Anyway, he was a naval man, and he spoke to the Naval Academy on their graduation one time and said essentially the same. He said that, you know, out of 100,000 people who can write, 10,000 actually show it to somebody. You know, 1,000 actually get some interest, and 100 can sell it. You know, it's,
and the ones that do aren't necessarily the best. The ones that can't sell aren't necessarily the best. Right?
Persistence.
Yeah.
Who you know. And
perseverance.
Luck.
Perseverance. Not quitting. Like, how many times do you feel like quitting? You just have to stop quitting.
I'm somewhat of a purist in this way, but, you know, I mean, I was a pretty comfortable town financially. And most people, you know, have an income from a job or a pension, and they don't really have to worry about their art paying their bills. You know, I mean, it's nice if you can make some money, but, you know, they don't have to worry about, you know, selling this or that to buy food. In other cities, it's not so much the case.
They're probably more exciting places, though.
Sorry?
They are probably more exciting places.
Well, you know, I went to art school in Detroit, and I was actually, I'm trained as a sculptor, I've been taking photographs all my life, and yet a lot of the students, sculptors I knew, were also working in the car factories, making in the design department, making clay mock-ups.
And
they were using their sculpture skills and getting well paid for it. You know, and then they were making sculpture in their off hours. And painters, I know, painting signs, and printmakers working in other places, you know, where they could use their skills, but in a town like Ottawa, you can't do that because there's no industry here.
Yeah.
So were they putting, like, the K car together or something?
I'm sorry?
Were they doing the K car? Or the
Well, no, they were often, you know, working in design. You know, one guy I knew actually made those what they call them, explosive drawings, where you have the, you know, like,
the
steering
parts.
Thing and it, all the things, those drawings too.
Parts manuals.
But
even New York and LA are full of, you know, artists, painters, and dancers, actors waiting tables.
Yeah. I mean, it's great if you can get a job where you can use your artistic skills, but more often than not, you're waiting tables or cleaning houses or doing it.
Always strikes me this city that we're in, for its size, I think is a hard city for art in general. A hard city. You've got the national galleries and, you know, the things like that, but there's not a lot of sales that I can see. And, you know,
would you say that's sort of the Canadian way? Because,
well, Toronto, I don't get the sense Toronto's like that, or Montreal, Quebec City, Calgary.
Let's take actors, for example. A lot of performance talents have to go outside of the country before they actually become recognized. And even when they come back to Canada, they're still like, oh, that's just so-and-so. He was my neighbor. I don't see that person.
Yeah, good point.
A young woman I know who actually had a full-time permanent position at Stratford. She's an actress, and she left Stratford because she didn't want to be caught in that trap, you know. And so she's in Ottawa, and she's working as an actress, but she makes her money doing voiceovers for commercials things like that. Because there's not a whole lot of acting jobs in Ottawa. She gets them, but
Now, next question is, can we educate an audience to appreciate art and photography?
Well, I
can buy it.
I mean, I think it's appalling that in this city we don't have a photography festival anymore.
Yeah, I do too.
I mean, Regina has one, Calgary has one, Saskatoon has one, Kamloops has one, and Ottawa does one. Can you
imagine? Yeah. That's just leadership from our friend.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's just a matter of somebody saying yes.
It's somebody
we'll
sitting
do it.
Down and doing, you know, I mean, we had one festival last for a number of years, and then it went belly up.
Why did it go belly up?
I think it went belly up because the people held on to it too tightly and they burned out.
Yeah.
I don't think they shared the decision.
Which one was that?
Festival X.
Festival X. Yeah.
Festival X.
And the last one was 2012, I think.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we were in 2012. But
yeah, that was
our
first
tell you, it was an appalling. I mean, there was basically no marketing being done. We had to do our own marketing. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah,
there was no coordination.
Yeah.
You call and you ask, get an answer from one, and you get a different answer from somebody else.
Yeah.
Or you get no answer at all.
Yeah. That comes down to requiring funding.
Yeah.
Yep.
And
That's
right.
Funding and resources.
Yeah.
So
we could make that happen.
We could.
Just $100 from each of us, and we'd get done probably.
Pick a date.
Well, somebody's got to take.
I'm just trying to see everyone here agreeing. You know, as a committee, I can just see you all agreeing to bring that about.
Yeah. Yes.
No,
exactly.
No. It's about my work.
Well, yeah, we get exclusive.
No, I used to talk it up. We talked about it a few years ago, but I've been doing other things. So. That's what it takes, is somebody with a will for it.
Well, I see in the interview with Peter Simpson, say that he says he's going to take it on now, but I want to see that happen.
Really?
He said he did. That's what he wants to go on to. But is this really going to happen? I don't know.
Didn't Tony Foose talk about doing something as well? Tony Foose talked about doing something.
Oh, he did, right? Yeah. At the same time we were talking about it. But he didn't. What?
Sorry?
He's going to take on what?
Well, create
photography
festival, a successor to Festival X.
Not Peter Simpson.
Not Peter. Peter was interviewing Guy Bubre about what's his, you know, as he's closing his gallery, what's his next step.
I didn't get, I read that article, I didn't think it was an exhibition as such, it was more
festival.
We'll do something here and there.
Yeah.
A weekend sort of thing.
Maybe it's not a World Cup game.
So, I don't know.
As opposed to Toronto, which lasts a month and has 150 venues.
Oh,
you ever go see it?
Yeah.
I was in it last year.
You were in it last year?
Yeah.
But it's mediocre.
Yeah.
A lot of it is.
Except for one.
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
Ralph.
I didn't mean you.
No, it's just another place to show them.
Yeah.
Do you benefit in it outside of the exposure? Was there any kind of... I like the comments I got in my book. But did you get any monetary?
No.
People bought work?
No.
People called up afterwards?
Again, it goes back to, are you trying to sell or... I've given up trying to sell them. This where I'm going these days, I don't think it's sellable. It's interesting. People like it, but it's not.
Yeah.
Have to be. Because otherwise I'm just... it's too depressing otherwise.
Yeah, the question, how much does it cost?
When you've been in business for 30 years, you always want to get some more.
It cost me $100 or whatever I could train down. So I figured probably, I already had the frames, nothing new. Probably $20 for matting and probably another $20 for printing.
That's not
good. Pictures?
No.
What gallery were you in?
I was in an optician's.
An optician? Oh, okay. So you had arranged that through the local business improvement district?
Correct.
The BIN.
And
yeah.
The people there couldn't see it very well.
It might have been an improvement. That was too easy.
It's not better going in.
But once they tried those masks,
the optician store sold really expensive retro frames.
But that's okay. That's okay.
Pay $500 for your frame, and, well, they didn't buy my arm. But no, it's worthwhile exposure. Yeah. I enjoyed it. Got my name there.
Yeah.
Would you do it again?
Yeah.
Since I don't know what kind of photographs were they? What was it?
A bed sheet.
I'll help you.
You'll need new glasses after.
Yeah. I gotta get my eye fixed.
You got them lasered.
Huh?
You got them lasered, didn't you?
So that was to fix the retinal tear. Now I have to go for
cataract.
Cataract. Yeah.
I'm getting that.
Sneak a look.
I've had that. Yeah. I got artificial lenses in both eyes. Yeah.
Oh.
Hey.
That won't help.
It's all about me.
I can tell. It's you in the middle, right?
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with it.
Mm. It's different.
Look by backwards or forward. But...
Interesting.
And to see more, I'll be at the Human
Library. Do you know a good festival? Have you been to one that you like?
Yeah.
You know, my criticism of the Contact Festival is that it's kind of, there's a whole lot of people who effectively subsidize them. So I guess the BIA took care of your fees. So that,
it
so.
Cost me $100.
Okay, so normally it costs quite a bit more.
Yeah, $500.
If you organize your own thing somewhere.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
And that just subsidizes whatever the hoity-toits in the festival decide it's going to be featured.
Right.
And I've been...
Get international people in.
All that stuff. And so it's a way of cross-subsidizing. And I don't find what the people there do particularly rigorous or particularly interesting or particularly coherent. It's kind of the same sort of issues and problems that plague us at the National Gallery or plague us in the academia that we allow to sort of to hold the keys, if you will, to what's in and what's out. Plus a few gallerists, whatever they are.
Where do you like? Anywhere at all.
I keep coming to these things, Jake, because it's interesting, because when we are all, you are all, trying to, I guess, make sense of this thing that we're involved with in one way or another. And but I guess maybe, if you look at, if you reflect on each of, sort of reflecting on different people's comments about different things, it can't be business at the same time, or it needs to be sort of set up and staged, there's so many ways of approaching or repeating the thing. But I think sometimes that then also becomes an excuse for, or curation, that we've done before. But these things become a bit of an excuse where we kind of project our own thing, and we feel that our own level of commitment to something or whatever else sort of justifies whatever we're doing. And there, I think there's often a real lack of rigor that we bring to our own work, but also a lack of rigor that we bring to others in terms of being honest with each other about what we're creating or not creating or whatever. And also, I think maybe in that vacuum where we don't
we're unable to have a, we're in some respects are in kind of contributing to kind of a visual illiteracy in some ways, we then also pass license to others who have really, just in many ways, in fact, less legitimate in terms of, you know, whatever their assertions might be about what is in or what is out or what is art or what is valuable or what is not valuable. And I think we're sort of a kind of a, we're in kind of a sort of dog chases tail kind of thing a little bit, or navel gazing, whatever the metaphor might be. And I think other groups are kind of doing the same sort of thing. There's something missing here in terms of us bringing some rigor, some substance to what we do, and not only to what we do individually, but to what we do in sort of a collective sense, frankly, I haven't been to whatever it's been in the National Gallery for a while, but I mean, I don't go because I'm appalled by what I see there. It just makes my blood pressure go up, and it's usually shit, and it's usually done very badly, and yet no one calls it, we don't call it often, but also there's no broader check or balance to that. The only people who might discuss it are since the very people who are creating the problem in the first place, who are in their mediocrity are able to kind of sustain themselves and are able to put up whatever they put up and just be dreadful. There's something missing. I'm just thinking of maybe where there's a difference. I don't know. I'm going to do the Writers Festival. Here's a plug. October 24th, Writers Festival, Christchurch Cathedral. I don't actually know where that is, but I'll be there with two other people. Not photographers, two environmentalists. So I've been plugged with these environmentalists, which is problematic too, so that should be fun. But there's a kind of a rigor that exists in the world of writing books, whether that's writing fiction or whether it's writing fact or the sort of editorial assertion of politics, whatever it is. But there's a rigor that gets brought to that. There's a coherence that gets brought to that. And sure, there's some good and bad, and there's certainly some variation. But broadly put, there's also a kind of a systemic support of this thing in terms of people writing things and books being presented in this kind of thing. And somehow I think that we miss that somehow in the work that we do. Notwithstanding our intent, notwithstanding our sincerity, I think, in our efforts. I think everyone here is quite keen and quite interested, but frankly, as best as I know, this is the only forum in this whole city where this anything approaching this occurs. This doesn't occur at SPOW, as best as I know. The kids at SPOW would never deign to come to this thing because it ain't cool kind of thing. And yet, you're at SPOW and you're involved in SPOW and you're involved in SPOW and I've been involved in SPOW and I think pretty much everyone here in some way or shape or form has been involved in SPOW. And yet, we don't. There's nothing going on. There's no cross-fertilization, as best that I know, that goes back to the hoity-toity at the National Gallery. And sure as fuck, there's no one here with a PhD in fine art or whatever it is, or in curation or art history or some of the nonsense, who are, they don't show up. They don't deign to be here because it isn't cool. Cool. Sorry? Maybe they're afraid of me. No, they don't even know who I am.
It goes beyond that. There's nobody here, and I'm not saying there's nobody here from the Fine Art Department of the University of Ottawa. Nobody here from Carleton. Yeah. Nobody here from the gallery in Carleton.
Right.
Nobody here from Algonquin's program.
How much of that is because they don't know about it?
That's a good point.
And I was talking to somebody last night, and that's a second-year SPOW student, and said, you can go to the FAPL meeting tonight.
Yeah.
And I said, what? Her? Well, so that's also part of it.
I forgot one part of my marketing. It used to be I would send it to admin at SPA, and they would get it on some Facebook page. But anyway, it never, nobody ever came.
But well, I mean, I've talked to Peter Simpson, told him
about this.
I don't think he showed up.
He's never showed up.
No. I mean, but
I've invited him explicitly a few times.
Yeah. I've done it behind the scenes too. You know, I kind of give him a poke to come and show up.
Why didn't he show up?
No, I mean, he's got things. He's got a range of things. He's busy. There's a set of priorities.
We got him at the Ottawa at the RA Photography Club in the Fine Art Group. Right. 1 year, and it took us basically a year to get him to come. Right. And he was quite adamant because he says, you know, look, I have so many invitations. You know, I can be out every night at something, and I have to choose what I go to. You know? And you got to catch me at a moment when, my calendar is open that night 6 months from now. So, yeah, okay, I'll do
it. That's how you did it. But still, but I'm just saying, and I'm just kind of casting about, because I struggle myself. I don't quite know how to put pieces together, but it's like what I'm impressed by, you know, when Jake pulls together here and the contributions that we make to this group, is that there is certainly a level of commitment and sincerity to this, but still there's this kind of gnawing kind of frustration. I feel this frustration because it's just sort of, it's just kind of incoherent, you know. We're all like talking in our own little bubble somehow, you know. One this and this, and we all have our own little thing.
That's making art, I think.
I don't agree with that. There's some people,
and
I don't know.
I mean, we do trade a bit here, you know. We do.
But I mean, like when I was doing my book, right? You know, I sought out a number of people to come to my place and look at the mess that I created to help me make sense of it.
Yeah.
Jake, you're part of that.
Yeah. Tony King. Well. Yeah. Tony Foos. Tony. And Michael. And
Michael.
Rena.
My spouse, of course.
Hey?
But my spouse.
She had to.
She had to, yeah. And, And that was extremely useful. That was an extremely useful process. Talk about curation, right? And it forced me in some ways to think in a way where didn't have my own little screen. Right? But I mean, personally, for me, I'm sort of stuck in a way too. I'm stuck in my own way. I'm caught in my own head. You know, and it's like.
It's also part of Louis. I understand, and I sympathize, and in fact, highly agree with a lot of what you're saying. But it's also part of what are the maybe not be the great use of the words I hear, but it's the circles that you're in. Okay, like Freeman, and I, and Richard are in a studio group. We do that to a degree.
Mm-hmm.
What you're saying, you know, your exercise with Michael and Tony, etc., work on your books. Well, that's what we do in our work. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
But we do it in a group of six.
Mm-hmm.
And we beat each other up over our work, or their work. No.
Mm-hmm.
We love each other's work.
It's always perfect.
It's all Freeman.
Tough love.
Okay.
Tough love.
But I agree with you. There are not very many of those.
Right.
That's part of the, you know, and you shouldn't have just one circle. I totally agree. You know?
Well, I was struck the video, for anybody who didn't hear, Michael Reichman and Brooks Jensen put out a video.
The Lenswork one.
Yeah, the Lenswork one. And Reichman said that what he's enjoying these days, and you know, this guy is accomplished, right, in every aspect of photography. And what he's enjoying these days is a few people get together and they show each other their prints and they talk about it.
That's what he's doing.
Should we be
evolving
as a group, bringing our work and showing our work?
Yeah, I'd be happy with that. Like I don't want to organize speakers anymore.
Maybe you kind of cut to the chase and all the crap often.
Yeah.
But also, yeah, gosh, that's a brilliant idea. I mean, I'll give it something that's slightly, it's analogous to that in a way, is that I remember the youngest group I've ever been a presentation with a bunch of grade 4 kids. I thought, no, what am I going to do here? Grade 4s. And so I brought a number of my portfolios with me, and I took the pictures out of these slips and all those plastic things, and I threw them on some tables, and the kids just went out and kind of picked them up, looked at them, and then this stuff started going on, and these were all my Tarsap stuff, and they started talking, and the thing was, the kids got it, like that, uh-huh. And they put it in their own words, but yeah. The difference between the adults that were grappling with my stuff, and these kids, they just got there faster, that's all. I mean, they just got there very quick, but in their own words. Yeah, it's really cool, kind of thing. Now, that's a little bit different, but in a sense, yeah, maybe that's... I think that's a good idea. Pictures on front of ourselves, and boom, you know...
We did it once.
We
did it once. Yeah, five people came, and we showed each other a print, and that was fun.
Might be a good idea.
I don't think we were too critical.
It depends if you're aiming for masses. I mean, almost have to limit the number of pictures everybody brings.
And maybe the number of people.
I mean, just a critical review. I mean, all of them look really pretty. I like the cat on the couch.
Yeah. I think I want better lights.
Or sign
up for class anymore. It's kind of a issue.
And, I mean, is it prints? You know, I mean, you can show stuff on your iPad, but I like prints.
I mean, all that stuff ultimately doesn't matter. Prints and some, I like the idea you do in studio, you know, first and then you get a print, get something there. I don't buy all the other stuff about prints and whatever else. Sure, I mean, nicely done print is a nice thing, but so what? There's so many different ways of showing things, which is great. I mean, I couldn't do what I do if it weren't for the fact that there's so many ways of showing things. Like, didn't exist 15 years ago, right? In terms of the venue for anyone to work on.
Right,
It is, that's maybe a good tool of doing your print. But it's something that is, I think it is, you know, move to an analogy, I suppose, you know, Stephen Harper, I hope there's no one here like Stephen Harper, but I mean, Stephen Harper, and in some ways, my main beef with Stephen, beef is the wrong word. Stephen Harper profoundly lacks an imagination.
Mm-hmm.
And he lacks, and with that goes empathy. You know, and so the response to this photo of Alan Kurdi, his child that was walked up on the beach, just tells you something about the man that I think has been obvious. It's obvious in that photo of him standing in an icebreaker or something with the flag fluttering in front of him in the Arctic, you know, on these trips. The man lacks. Imagination. But I think in some senses it also reflects something that we have as a problem in our Anglophone part of the country, and that is that there is something lacking there. There's a lack of a collective imagination. There's a lack of a visual literacy. There's a lack of... We're stuck on Group of Seven. You know, you ask someone what art is, and it's Group of Seven. You know, and if they're really up to speed, they'll talk about Emily Carr, maybe, or something, right? But the thing is, the people who are the leaders, if you will, the critics, whoever they are, and the academics or the galleries, they keep trying that shit out, right? You know, it's the next. They'll keep going back to that same thing because there's something really growing and changing. It's like we're stuck in our visuals with something that was innovative 90 years ago. We haven't evolved, and the whole rest of the world has evolved. And maybe there is hope when you look at other areas. I think we're all. I might actually be the youngest person here.
Be.
but I think we all know of a time when Canadian music sucked. And we all know the time when Kenya literature was just dreadful. And yet, those two areas, I think, have really matured and grown in a way that the people who are successful there now are not, they're not Canadian anymore. Mm-hmm. They're being Canadian is no longer relevant.
Yeah.
Whereas 25 or 30 years ago, that was important. There was this whole, they were real, my favorite phrase, they were world class, right, when they weren't. So there are other areas, I think, where we have evolved culturally, but in the realm of visual arts, I think not. I mean, whether it's with photography or whether it's with I think painting, I think the same thing is true. We're just kind of stuck. I mean, at the moment, I mean, I think it's different in Quebec. Quebec is different. There's something else. It's different. It's building. Works
it's interesting you say. I mean, I don't disagree with anything, but University of Ottawa Art Department would claim you're wrong because they do not teach the Group 7. They do not teach any of the Art 7. They claim that the literacy issue is because the rest of the educational system is focused on that, whereas they're miles, years, whatever, ahead of that. Okay, they're pumping out constructionists, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They don't teach the traditions at all, they claim.
I remember
now, whether it's true or not, I don't know.
I remember trying to read this woman there. I don't know her name. And I would certainly put her name on tape, so to speak, if I knew it, but I don't, which is tells something as well, too. But she's the University of Ottawa academic. She has a book on the state of photography. I think it's called The Death of Photography in Canada.
Yeah.
Try reading that book.
Well, that's an academic book.
My wife just finished her PhD. Congratulations to Kristen. Got it a few weeks ago. And absolutely not. I disagree. Sure, there are academics that are opaque and incoherent. Totally. But this goes beyond the pale.
Yeah.
Like, this is complete. It's not. You can't even read it from paragraph to paragraph because it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
Like, there's no rigor there whatsoever. And so this person who has a PhD, who, and presumably is a mentor to other people, is writing this gibberish that, because she's an academic, she gets it published and what have you, and there's no real feedback in terms of sales. I just think, why don't we tell that? Why isn't that held to account? Where is the sort of check and balance on that? Absolutely not. No, there is no criticism.
And so people are chicken shit.
That's part of it. And there is a social dynamic that's at work too.
That's the Canadian way.
You're too friggin' polite.
Polite. We don't wish to offend.
Yeah. Or it's an excuse for not being rigorous, like for just simply not being rigorous. I mean, it's being polite is to actually not engage. Being polite is not to actually ask hard questions of yourself and look in the mirror. Be the first thing, and then the next thing is to look at the other person and engage with them. I mean, I'll give another analogy. That's the issue that I've been so involved with the tar sands or oil sands, right? Even the name, is it tar or oil? I use when I write notes and things and I'm pitching my book. Pitching like crazy the last little while. I write tar/oil. And the next time I write it, I write oil/tar. And it's the name. You can't agree on the name. It
depends on who you are. I work in the oil industry. We use oil.
That's right. But if you, 25 years ago.
We're mandated to use oil. Oh, I know.
15 years ago, it was tar sands.
Anybody who lived there, it was the tar sands.
But the whole thing, ultimately, it reeks of an inability of ourselves to look ourselves in the mirror about what we do or what we don't do, and ask ourselves hard questions about how remarkable it is that it's only once the price of oil tanked, which was absolutely predictable, but of course it was never going to happen, right? According to the narrative 12 months ago, 18 months ago. All of a sudden, then we could talk about the high price of the Canadian dollar and the consequences, or the sovereignty fund, the heritage fund, you couldn't talk about these things before when we were in that boom cycle. And again, there's something Canadian about that, being unable to grapple with hard things until it's too late. I don't know exactly. So that was my, one of the things that really got my attention the first time I was there, was this sort of failure of civil society and political culture, where we weren't able to grapple with this extremely important thing, whether they hated it or liked it, who cares? It was just like, and that was where the drama was in terms of photographing this thing, was because we were sticking our heads into the sand or something, you know, in some way. And that doesn't help. That actually, in my view, you know, there's all these environmental consequences and that, and those are horrible and whatever, but the real problem is for the industry ultimately, because they couldn't themselves grapple with, you know, a reality that spoke to what we were doing, to then, you know, mitigate the long-term consequences of what they were doing and make sure they actually had a sustainable business plan in place. Just look at what's going on in the industry. So maybe it's endemic to human culture that we don't grapple with, you know, grapple with things. Maybe I'm going way off, too far off topic.
Well, it is a bit, isn't it? I think the really interesting question for us is, why isn't photography more rigorous, like the word you use, right? Why, and how to make that happen? And in relation to literature and music, things happen there, right? But all the time that Canada was learning to make good music, there was a lot of bad music being played.
Actually, one of the reasons why Canada started creating more music had a lot more to do with the CRTC.
See, decision on mandatory Canadian content. And CBC did a show about 3 weeks ago on that.
They're actually, you know, like, I was in broadcasting for a number of years, and even though we, in the early years that I was in, had Canadian content requirements, it wasn't until a bunch of stations realized that, hold on a second, we can meet Canadian content requirements, we can also meet the local programming requirements, and we can do all sorts of other things if you start having annual band audition contests. And I think that actually drove more Canadian talent to be recognized and discovered than the 25% CanCon or 40% CanCon.
I remember those contests.
I'd say they were the ones that really propelled Canadian talent outside of their boxes.
So to translate,
before that, everything was always Anne Murray, Gordon Lightfoot, whatever.
To translate that over, though, I mean, you need a government mandate to make photography better? Like, is there not some way?
But the problem there is, I mean, if you gave the people who would be the, at least as institutions see themselves, the natural quote unquote fit for dictating, you know, what the terms would be, I mean, you would end up with the very same people who run the Center or the National Gallery or Contact or a few other things. Those are the people who would be the sort of that, they'd be the adjudicators.
And that the same thing happens in a photography festival. It's sort of what's dampened my interest in trying to get one going is that the arts professionals take over.
Right. And the thing is, they're neither professional nor are they artists. There's something else there, and it's got nothing to do with.
I've got some reading for you.
So, I mean, yeah, maybe there is something to be taken from where there has been success, where there has been a trajectory.
Right. Well, that's what I'm wondering,
You know, where,
like, what can you abstract
in literature or in music, or maybe there are other areas too that I'm not aware of, but where we actually have, with a concerted public effort, there has been a shift to the point where there has been an evolution, and there's really good stuff that's now coming, you know, from the pens of Canadian writers. I mean, think of what CBC does for, you know, Sounds Like Canada, let's say, right? Mm-hmm. Or the Sheila Rogers, what's her program called? Or Eleanor Wachtel's program. You know, and what that does for that's intentional. You know, and there are good people there who then are very, very good at their job in terms of, you know, in terms of pulling that out. And you're good at your job in terms of doing what you're doing with, you know, with your recorder and your podcast and whatever else. And why isn't there more of a place for that kind of conversation? Why isn't there more of, the CBC contest? As someone who talked about the CBC contest, about the, you know, about having photographers being sent to different places and telling a different narrative or whatever, why, you know, I mean, that's gimmicky. That actually starts, you know, we could argue, quibble about these things. Mm-hmm. It becomes like Survivor or something like that.
Go back to your comment earlier, which is, you know, when we look at art, we're stuck in a group of seven. And there is no battle of the artists out there either. We don't have that public consciousness. And could it be that, you know, what people are willing to spend money on is, well, buy that for $1.29 on the website and Packard or Privet or Steelix or whatever it is?
No, I don't think so. Because, I mean, this is one of the lessons that we learned a long time ago was, you know, we had three sizes of prints. One was $200, one was $500, and one was it was going to be $1,000. But then we
based on the square footage, not on the content. We then value our prints based on the square footage, not on the content.
No, that wasn't. But there was a correlation between the size. There's a correlation between the size of my prints and the price of the prints, absolutely. But we assumed the small ones at a better price was going to be stuff that sold, and the stuff that sold was the stuff that was selling for $950. We chickened out on $1,000, so we had $950, and it became $1,072.50, which is what it is with tax. I know that memorized, but that's what we were selling. Like, it was like Kristen and I would look at each other and go, "What?" We just thought that was kind of a loss leader to print these big things, but it was actually that which we sell the most of. Plus, it's also where we made the most money, and that's correlated a little bit with the larger ones I've done after that too. Not enough, but people are not looking on the basis of price. They're looking at, you know, they want this thing and they want, you know, they've got to have a price tag on it because it's got to fit with their expectations of that, which is what it's valuable. And then it's not about, and they can go and print it, they can easily rip it off my site and print it in the Excel size and photos. They're not going to do that. And some people will, a lot of there's something else at work there in terms of people valuing it. Arguably, by putting a big price tag on it, they value it, and they wouldn't if I had it for half the price.
Well, yeah, people always put a value on what they pay for, so if it's free.
Yeah, I don't know, totally. I think that there's a definite, there's a diverse, it's the Lexus effect.
It's interesting you make that point there, because in us, we've been struggling with how we value our work for our coming exhibit. And for the most part, I'd say we've almost concluded we've been overvaluing our work. Because overvaluing. You're right. And they're not necessarily synonymous. That's right. Okay. Overpricing our work. Because when we look at what's actually been selling, same size, slightly less than we've been charging, it sells, and ours, on a percentage basis, you know, the numbers, hasn't been selling quite as much. What is this market in this city that drives a sale price, you know, that it's hard, it's very hard to come to grips with, you know, what works, what doesn't.
I see some stuff, and it's a value, let's say, $300 for 11-14, whatever the amount. And I try and sell my stuff at least two or three times that amount, and I found good. How can somebody do anything with the $300? Because it doesn't cover the frame, it doesn't cover all of our expenses, it doesn't cover our time or whatever.
Right. We're at that, you know, what's that place on Richmond Road there, Westburg? Also good. The show that's going on.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
There's a guy that, nice work, not photographic Iceland stuff, beautiful. The frame with glass, matted, and the print, $300. And they were, I'll say, 16, 24 or something like that. How the hell can you afford to sell them that?
Uh-huh.
But he's doing it. And he's got to be a lost leader.
I remember a story that came out not that long ago. Bansky.
Yeah.
He was in New York City one year and selling his work in Central Park. I think he was trying to sell them for, I can't remember exactly, $100 a piece or something like that. And one person, you know, got it because they just moved into the apartment. They just wanted some cheap art to fill up the walls. And another person bargained it down to get two for the price of one.
Mm.
So essentially what happened was he sold about $500 or $600 worth of work, which was actually truly valuable. It had hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Yeah.
And but that's
the,
it was the context. Yeah. It was selling it in Central Park.
Yeah.
But people would okay.
Good point.
You know.
Yeah.
By the way, like in a way, just going off on that tangent, I'm gonna fault since I started it, but in some ways, you know, who cares? That's a different part of it. And I don't think that speaks to the regular at all. It speaks to creating a perception. Right? If I sell something for $3,000, then the people who bought my stuff for that price would think, wow, that's great, because Potinsky's stuff costs $50,000, so you're getting a good deal.
What
right?
about that guy that has the most valuable photograph sold, the $10
million?
Oh, yeah. And have you ever heard anything lately on that?
No.
It seems to have disappeared into the myth.
Oh, really?
I'd be happy to sell it and disappear, but
it showed up.
I thought it was $6
million.
Well, whatever. The whole value of this package.
But I mean, but still, just to pull back a little bit, because we're all caught up in that. In terms of worrying about that, there's a slight overlap, but
but you know, it's not an excuse at all, but look at how many famous painters, like what's his name, the guy who cut off his ear, the painter, he never sold, he sold one work in his life before he died, one work, everything else was sold, and the price range afterwards, that's right, you know.
I tell my kids that's their inheritance.
That's right.
But that's also, the same. It's sort of the same variation of what we said about Ansel Adams, and we didn't really get traction until he was late in life. I don't buy that either. The idea that an artist has to be a starving
artist—that's
a myth.
I'm not sure how we got on the money. I sort of missed it, but I think what would be more concern to all of us would be. Trying to create an atmosphere where we get better. And where we make photography more valued in society.
If we're talking about looking for ways of getting better, then we should all be bringing work to the show.
I'm good with that.
Like I agree with the way it's always worked in the past, where we learn from the guest speaker.
Yeah.
But maybe we should have a...
Or alternate them at least.
Alternate, or even a double component where there's a component where we show our work and a component where there's a speaker.
Yeah.
Even in the same evening.
I'm giving up getting speakers. So I'm happy to, you know, keep something going, but I don't want to get speakers anymore.
Need a brighter venue.
Yeah, and if we want to look at pictures, we do.
Yeah. Sure, yeah. Quieter venue.
But,
we're quieter.
Quieter and brighter. I have individuals' houses. I don't know.
Certainly
I don't know how many people. You know, if we said it has to be prints, that'll cut down on the number of people who show up. But anyway, I just all I'm saying is I want to stop organizing speakers. I'm happy to continue on with this initiative. I'm happy to show up for speakers. But anybody wants to get into it?
I didn't order that. Pour the glass of water, Roman. Or better on his microphone.
Hey,
it's
So Carillion was our last speaker.
Carillion. No. We got two more here. So October is we're gonna do. There's this guy who taught at SPOW, Kappa. Kappa
Rod
Critique.
Martin.
No.
Rod Tider.
No. Chris. Kloos.
Chris Kloos. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And anyway. So he taught the Kappa way of critiquing.
Yeah.
You know, like in the clubs. You know, they have the contest, and I took it just wondering what this was all about. And he's a very good speaker. So I suggested that he come and talk to us. And that we
isn't that the guy from New Orleans?
Yeah, we try and relate that kind of a critique to. I told him at one point, I don't really care what your critique says about my picture. You know, I'm trying to say something else. This is art. He said, well, it still matters. You know, it's like, I mean, if you can present your concept in a well composed picture, isn't it going to be more effective? So anyway, to have some kind of a dialogue between that kind of sort of mechanical critique and art. That's what's next week, our next month. And then after that, I forget.
You going to have photos for him to critique?
Maybe. Yeah. Does anybody want to put some in?
No.
I mean, if it's the guy, I think it is. Yes, we should.
one image.
I'm a certified Kappa judge, too.
Okay.
I think if it's the guy, I think it is. I'm not one of them else. With all respect to my friend here, and you did well choosing, I'm not saying that. He's not one of our outstanding judges.
I'm sure you guys have your hierarchy, whatever. He's a very clear speaker, and he's willing to do this. So, images, they'll be his images, you know. We'll put them up on the screen. So, and then I forget what's next, but something else. And then December.
But you know, I mean, I'd have a suggestion. Try, and I'm not saying, you know, I know you want to bow out here. But we're going to talk about building on the discussion we've had here today on the critiquing and the circle of mutual support, etc. And the commercial, you know, in the issue within a commercial world of how you're successful. Let's ask Rod Tider. Rod is a commercial, very successful photographer out of Toronto, still runs a print shop in Toronto, big in the Toronto scene, okay? Commercial in the sense of he's not shooting weddings or portraitures, but he shoots,
advertising.
Well, advertising type, transit, the buses whatever the hell the Toronto Transit Commission is, okay? But in an artistic sense, okay? Makes his money. His wife is the chief executive officer in Elmont of the hospital, so he's moved here, but he still commutes back and forth, okay? Brilliant, good speaker, and he can tell you the honest goods and compare Ottawa with Toronto in terms of the commercial scene of how the hell do you sell work. Photographic work in this city versus Toronto.
Yeah.
Be an interesting discussion.
Maybe somebody wants to organize
it. I'll talk to him if you want. Just give me a date that I can ask him for a couple of
weeks.
I know him.
Okay,
well.
Okay.
So. But if you guys want, I mean, I'm not pushing them on it. Yeah, I'm just saying it's an offer.
Yeah, sounds like a good figure.